Hello, my name is Arya Javidan, and I'm the project manager for the National Consortium of Telehealth Resource Centers. Welcome to today's webinar, Data Interoperability, What's Changing, What It Means, and How to Prepare. Today's webinar is hosted by the Northwest Regional Telehealth Resource Center, and these webinars are designed to provide timely information and demonstrations to support and guide the development of your telehealth programs. To provide a little bit of background on the consortium, located throughout the country, there are 12 regional telehealth resource centers and 2 national, one focused on telehealth policy and the other on telehealth technology. Each serve as focal points for advancing the effective use of telehealth and supporting access to telehealth services in rural and underserved communities. We did want to highlight that the consortium is collecting success stories from organizations, patients, and providers who have benefited from telehealth with support from a telehealth resource center. Share how your TRC has helped make telehealth work for you for a chance to be featured along with your organization in our monthly consortium newsletter. A few tips before we get started today. Your audio has been muted. Please use the Q&A function of the Zoom platform to ask questions. That is located at the bottom of your screen. Questions will be answered at the end of the presentation. Please only use the chat feature for communicating issues with technology or communication access issues. Please refrain using the chat to ask questions or make comments. Please note that closed captioning is also available, and that is located at the bottom of your screen. Today's webinar is also being recorded, and you will be able to access today's and past webinars on the NCTRC YouTube channel and the NCTRC website at telehealthresourcecenter.org. With that, I will pass it over to Jalene Johnson, Assistant Program Director for the Northwest Regional Telehealth Resource Center.
Thank you so much, Arya, and welcome to our webinar today. Again, my name is Jalene Johnson. I'm the Assistant Program Director for the Northwest Regional Telehealth Resource Center. As you saw in Arya's previous slide, there are 14 telehealth resource centers across the nation, 12 regional and 2 national. The Northwest covers Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. You can see our resources and contact us at nrtrc.org. Next slide, please. Before we just get started, I want to preface the conversation just by noting that next week, in partnership with the University of Washington Behavioral Health Institute, we are holding a telebehavioral health summit. The focus is artificial intelligence and behavioral health, promise, practice, and responsibility. If you like what you see today, Dr. Warren Patin is one of the speakers for that event. It is free and fully virtual. So go ahead and log on, register, attend what you can or attend the whole summit. We would love to have you there. Everything will be recorded afterwards as well. As long as you just sign up, you should receive the information. But we will put a link into the chat as well for you all to register if you are interested in that. Next slide, please. Without further ado, I am very, very privileged to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Warren Patin. Warren is a assistant professor of psychiatry at the Huntsman Mental Health Institute at the University of Utah and a member of the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program with affiliations in biomedical informatics and biomedical engineering. His research focuses on how physiological and behavioral health data can be used to better understand and predict health and disease. Dr. Patin leads a cross-disciplinary research program developing interpretable artificial intelligence for health monitoring using wearable devices, physiological telemetry, and electronic health records. His laboratory analyzes complex time series data to detect early physiological changes associated with aging, cardiovascular disease, and neuropsychiatric conditions. The group integrates computational neuroscience, machine learning, and physiological modeling to build clinically meaningful digital biomarkers. His work combines theory, behavioral experiments, and computational modeling, including biophysical neural networks, reinforcement learning, and artificial neural networks. These approaches are informed by neural and physiological time series data and tested through experimental tasks and large-scale digital platforms. Dr. Patin received his medical degree from the University of Colorado School of Medicine and completed research in training and computational neuroscience at Stanford, New York University, and Yale. So without further ado, welcome again, Dr. Warren Patin, and I'm going to hand the stage over to you.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. So sharing screen, hopefully everyone can see it now. Thanks everybody. I'm Warren, assistant professor at the U. So I'm going to be upfront about something. This talk is about data interoperability reform. And this sounds like one of those topics where somebody just reads off federal regulation language and you spend 40 minutes checking your email. So I'm going to try hard not to do that, and hopefully we can get to some questions at the end where we really drill down. But what I really want to do is connect these policy changes that are happening right now to work that you do every day. Because these changes are really going to hit your workflow, whether we're ready for them or not. And so a quick disclosure, I'm affiliated with Mountain, which works on really making sense of health data. And so interfaces a lot with these kind of reforms, but this talk is purely educational and we're not going to touch on the details of what Mountain does. So let's start actually with a story that some of you will recognize. A patient in a remote Alaska village has a medical emergency. They get medevaced to Anchorage. The village clinic runs the Indian Health Service electronic health record system, but that was built decades ago, independently from every commercial EHR on the market. It doesn't speak the new EHR language. It doesn't connect to any health information exchange. It is, for all practical purposes, invisible to the rest of the health IT ecosystem. So what happens when that patient lands in Anchorage? The records, they arrive by fax machine, maybe by phone. The specialists do their work, and when the patient goes home, the specialist note comes back as a scanned PDF, oftentimes has to be printed and faxed and scanned again. Medication reconciliation happens over the phone, if it happens at all. And somewhere in this long chain, things get missed. Follow-up orders, medication changes, allergies, and these are all gaps that put patients at risk. Now, this is 2026. We have self-driving cars being tested in San Francisco and throughout the country, and we're still faxing medical records. And so that disconnect is what this talk is really about. So I'm a scientist, so let's jump into the numbers. 70% of hospitals still use fax for at least some portion of their health data exchange. That's from the ONC data based on the AHA survey. And it's a small, rural facilities that really depend on fax machines the most. Now, only 36% of rural hospitals routinely engage in interoperable exchange across different domains. Now, compare that with 47% for urban hospitals and 53% for system-affiliated hospitals. And if you're part of a big health system running Epic, your data mostly flows. But if you're an independent facility, that number drops to 22%. Only 48% of rural and small hospitals have electronic patient information available at the point of care. Now think about that. More than half of the time when a provider at a small rural clinic sees a patient, they don't have the full picture. Now patient matching accuracy across all these different databases sits at about 90%, which sounds good until you just really drill down and think that means 1 in 10 patient matches is wrong or missed. And so that's just slightly different spellings and names across different systems or repeats in the exact same name and being able to tell those people apart. And so when you're reconciling medication lists across different facilities, that 10% error rate is really dangerous. And then there's the timing. 2026 is the year when three major federal frameworks are converging at the same time. That's going to be TEFCA, CMS, interoperability rules, and HIPAA reforms. And so that's really what we're going to walk through today. So here's the roadmap. There's going to be three sections. First is TEFCA, and this is the federal network of networks that's supposed to enable nationwide health data exchange. We're going to go into what it is, how it works, and where it falls short for rural providers. Second, the CMS interoperability rules. These are the standardized APIs, or a push for standardized APIs, that are transforming prior authorization and opening up key payer data. And this is where the most immediate workflow changes are coming from. And the third is HIPAA reform, and that's a security overhaul, privacy updates, and the end of the behavioral health data silo. And then we'll kind of bring this all together and talk about what you can really do. What are the actionable steps? Now let's start with Tefka. I want you to meet Janet. Janet is a telehealth coordinator and RN at a 25-bed critical access hospital in rural eastern Montana. Her hospital runs Truebit Bridge as its EHR. Their hub partner, Billings Clinic, runs Epic. There's no shared health information exchange connecting the two. So here's Janet's day. Every referral she sends to Billings Clinic gets printed from TrueBridge, faxed, and then when the specialist notes come back, somebody manually re-enters them into her system. That process eats 2 to 3 hours of clinical staff time every single day, not per week, per day. It introduces transcription errors, delays follow-up, and creates exactly the kind of gap that we've been talking about so far. So Janet heard a Tefka, likely through a talk like this. She doesn't understand what participation would require, how much it would cost, or how to get started. She has one part-time IT technician, and that's her entire technology team. So Tefka is supposed to fix this, and let's talk about what it actually is. Tefka stands for Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement. So it grew out of the 21st Century Cures Act, which is really a critical one for health data exchanges and just the ability to have interoperability. And it instructed the national coordinator of that act to build a framework for a nationwide health data exchange, but Tefka itself is actually managed by a nonprofit. So the core promise is simple. Connect to one qualified health information network, or QIN, and you can reach every other QIN and their participants nationwide. One connection, nationwide reach. So instead of building custom interfaces with every hospital and every health system, you plug into one network and that network just handles the rest. So there are currently 11 designated QINs, including common names like eHealth Exchange, which is the oldest and largest, Epic Nexus, which covers the entire Epic ecosystem, Kanza, SureScripts, which already runs the pharmacy network, and eClinicalWorks. And the scale has grown fast. About 50 million records exchanged, over 70,000 connected sites, and just really a lot of explosive growth through 2025. At the start of 2025, it was 10 million documents. By the end of the year, 464 million. So that's the network effect in action. The more organizations can join, the more organizations that join, the more valuable it becomes for really everybody. Now, a key thing, too, is that a QIN doesn't store the patient data in a central database. It operates more like a switchboard. So your data stays at the source. And when another provider needs records of your patient, that request gets routed through the QIN network to wherever the patient has been seen. And then the data comes back. And so the QIN maintain a record locator service, basically a directory that knows where patients have received care, but the clinical records themselves stay local. That's the promise. Reality check. So on the left side here is what works. If you're on Epic, Tefka was, and we're quoting from one implementation report, a matter of updating a couple settings. Epic built its own QIN, Epic Nexus, so their customers get connected almost by default. So if you're on a major platform that's either become a QIN itself or is connected to one, the path is really, really smooth. And there are really only two on-ramps for any provider. Either your EHR vendor becomes a Tefka participant or becomes a QIN itself. And so Epic, for example, became a QIN itself because it had such a large network, whereas other ones can kind of plug into those systems. Or your regional health information exchange becomes a Tefka participant and you connect through them. So if there's already a HEI in place, those can connect to QINs. And so all of that kind of gets handled in the back end. So what doesn't work about this? If you're on TrueBridge, an older Meditech, Athena, or IHS, RPMS, that path to TEFCA is really unclear. These vendors either can't afford to become QINs, haven't prioritized it, or in the case of RPMs, are federal systems dependent on congressional appropriations that just really haven't come yet. So only 39% of non-networked hospitals even intend to participate in the program. The TEFCA agreement also lacks provisions for tribal data governance. Tribal organizations, they assert data sovereignty, and that's the principle that tribes own and control the health data about their members. And so participating in a QIN could expose the tribal data to queries from non-tribal entities in ways that conflict with tribal law or cultural norms. So that's really a fundamental tension that is yet to be resolved in some of this. And there's still no universal patient identifier. We're stuck with probabilistic matching at about 90% accuracy, and that's going to be through at least 2030. And so again, that's if it's Sam Smith, which Sam Smith is it? And is that the same as Samuel Smith, et cetera? It's a hard problem. It's one that there's a lot of cool techniques for, but it can get you to about 90%. So TEFCA is real. It's growing and it matters. But if you're Janet in Montana with TrueBridge and one IT person, it just hasn't really reached you yet. So now we're going to get into the CMS interoperability rules. This one is the most concrete. It's where the near-term changes are really happening. So let's meet Tom. Tom runs a 3-provider rural health clinic in Wyoming. He has one billing specialist. She completes 39 prior authorizations per week across different payer portals, each with different documentation requirements, different login credentials, different submission formats. So that's 13 hours of staff time every week just on prior authorization at a 3-provider clinic. That staff time not spent on patient care, not spent on anything else that moves the clinic forward. And this is all stuff I'm sure that is very frustrating for any of you that are living this. And here's the cost that really makes one's jaw drop. A manual prior authorization, and that's the fax phone portal, costs about $3.52. Using it and doing it electronically, that's 5 cents. So that's a 70x gap. That means that clinics are spending 70 times more than they need to on a process that nobody really thinks is the fun part of their job. Providers hate it, staff hate it, patients hate it when their care gets delayed. And so the CMS interoperability rule, CMS 0057-F, it's designed to close that gap and really solve that problem. And so I'll walk you through what's already in effect and really what's coming. But this is the one that, you know, I think is pretty exciting. So phase one is live. It took effect in January 1st of this year. So the first is faster prior authorizations or PA decisions. Payers in Medicare Advantage, Medicaid Managed Care, CHIP, and the exchange plans now have 7 days to make a standard prior authorization decision and 72 hours for expedited requests. So a massive kind of change in the amount of times that's allowed. So this doesn't cover every commercial plan that's out there, but for the patient populations that likely most of you serve, it covers a lot of the payers that you deal with. If you've ever waited 3 weeks for a PA response for one of these plans, at least in theory, that era is over. Second, specific denial codes. And so this is a bigger deal than it might sound, especially for us data nerds. Previously, when payer denied a prior authorization, they could send back not medically necessary and just leave it at that. It's just a total black box for why this decision was made. Now they have to provide standardized, specific reason codes. Was the documentation incomplete? Did the clinical information not meet criteria for that specific service? Was there a preferred alternative? You get an actual answer you can act on. And so that makes the appeals faster and more targeted. Third, public PA metrics. So name and shame, basically. So the first reports were due March 31st of this year. For the first time ever, you can compare payers' approval and denial rates, their average decision times, and their appeal outcomes side by side. So this is going to be an entirely new tool in your toolbox, in patients' toolboxes as they choose different forms of insurance, in organizations as well. And so this especially matters, all of this matters, this data interoperability, because of the AI trends. So 61% of physicians in a 2024 AMA survey expressed concern that payers' use of AI is increasing denial rates. And a Senate investigation found that during a period when Humana was deploying AI decision-making tools, post-acute care denial rate was 16 times higher than its overall denial rate. And here's the kicker. 82% of Medicare Advantage PA denials are overturned on appeal, but only 0.2% of patients actually appeal. So the system generates mass wrongful denials, and it works because almost nobody fights back. And so these public metrics and these sort of specific denial codes and these faster decisions really give you the data to fight back against that and to also kind of automate the responses and the compilation of data to argue persuasively for care that needs to happen. So phase two arrives January of 2027, and this is the bigger technical lift. There are four Fire-based APIs that must be live. So Fire, I'm not going to go into too much detail about that. It's a data format. It's a way that people are supposed to organize the data, and we can kind of leave it at that. And an API is an application programming interface. And so you can just think of that as ways that computers talk to each other. And so Fire is kind of the language they need to use, and APIs are the way that they're connected so that they can transmit that language. So there are patient access and provider access APIs. And patients will be able to pull their claims, PA status, and denial reasons through apps. And for the first time, clinicians will be able to pull payer health data in near real time. And so that means claims histories, big one, medication refills, discharge information from other facilities. This is the data that has just been a bane of not having access to that now in theory is going to be showing up in your EHR. So then there's the payer-to-payer API. And so this is when a patient switches insurance plans, that new plan can electronically request up to 5 years of clinical and claims data from the old plan. So think about your Medicaid patients who churn through coverage changes. Instead of starting from scratch every time they switch plans, that history follows them. And so that's going to be huge for continuity of care. And the prior authorization API. So this means structured electronic PA submission through the EHR, replacing the portals, fax, and phones. This is where cost drops from $3.52 to 5 cents. And yeah, that'll be great. So who has to comply? Well, Medicare Advantage plans, Medicaid, and CHIP managed care, and qualified health plan issuers. So this is a payer rule primarily, all of this, but it really affects you because these APIs affect what data follows. And how you interact with payers every day and what data can really flow to you. And so the catch is always is that the benefit depends on the EHR vendor actually building the tools to consume these APIs. If your vendor is slow, you will have to wait for those data. So everyone's favorite mandatory yearly training, HIPAA. Let's talk about HIPAA and HIPAA reform. And we'll kind of mostly focus on correcting some misconceptions that are probably costing people more than they realize, and in the future definitely will. So first meet Dr. Okafor. He's a telebehavioral health psychologist working across three states and five facilities. Now, until very recently, his work involved a uniquely painful data problem. So substance use disorder lived in completely separate siloed data from the rest of a patient's medical record. They had their own consent framework under 42 CFR Part 2, and that's far more restrictive than HIPAA. So that means every time Dr. Okafor wanted to share information about a patient's SUD treatment with their primary care provider, they needed to get a separate consent form. And if that information got shared, the recipient couldn't pass along without yet another consent. The results, 30 to 45 minutes of duplicative documentation and manual note transmission every single day. And more importantly, PCPs couldn't see their patient's substance use disorder treatment history through normal data exchange channels and care coordination for patients with co-occurring conditions. It just became fundamentally broken. So before we really get into what's changed, let's talk about like a HIPAA misconception that I think kind of really gunks things up. So HIPAA explicitly grants patients access rights to their own medical records. And this is the part people miss. HIPAA permits extensive data sharing over treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. So you can share health and clinical information with other treating providers. You can share with payers for payment. You can share for quality improvement without the, you know, extensive individual patient consent. HIPAA allows that. And so organizations that over-restrict sharing because of HIPAA are often more out of compliance than those who share appropriately. And now with information blocking enforcement active under the Cures Act, refusing to share the data you're allowed to share, it can really get you into a lot of trouble. ONC is issuing notices of nonconformity to EHR developers. So over 1,600 information blocking complaints have been filed. And this is no longer an aspirational policy. It's really in the active enforcement stage. So just kind of take this back to your organizations. HIPAA can be an enabler of data sharing and not necessarily a barrier. The barrier is really our misunderstanding of the details, which, you know, there's a lot there. So it makes sense why it's a lot to kind of wade through. So we'll spend a second on this one, the three simultaneous shifts that are happening in HIPAA. And they're all really happening at once. And I imagine, too, we'll get some kind of questions about this. So, I would imagine take some notes. So, number one, 42 CFR Part 2 alignment. So this took effect in February of 2026. And so substance use disorder treatments now, in theory, should flow under the same treatment, payment, and operations framework as other clinical data. That means patients should be able to sign one durable consent form, and then their substance use disorder treatment history can be shared with other treating providers through standard channels. So that includes things like the TEFCA, the HIEs, and payer APIs that we've been talking about. And so this is the end of the last major federal data silo. For Dr. Okafor, that means that the PCP down the road can finally see that patient is in medication-assisted treatment. Now, it also means that the ED physician has context when a patient shows up in crisis, which, when I talk to my emergency medicine physician friends, is really an issue. And one important protection that survived, though, and this is important for patient privacy, in particular in rural communities, is that SUD records still can't be used against patients in criminal, civil, or administrative proceedings without specific court orders. That protection remains. And so it's not like it's just entirely been opened up. There still are some controls. And so number two, and this is unrelated, is the security rule overhaul. And so this is proposed. It's not final. And it's generating a lot of pushback. And so the big change here is it eliminates the distinction between addressable and required specifications. Right now, the security rule says that some safeguards are required and others are addressable. And so what that means is you can implement them if reasonable or document why you didn't, if something is addressable. In practice, addressable became really a loophole that a lot of organizations used. And so the proposed rule makes everything mandatory regardless of facility size. So that means mandatory encryption, multi-factor authentication on the phones, annual penetration testing, and 72-hour system restoration. And so the estimated industry-wide cost is $34 billion over the next 5 years. And so over 100 hospital systems have urged the HHS to withdraw it. The final target implementation is mid-2026, but that's widely considered optimistic. So number three, the privacy rule update. And so this one is good news. So it would reduce the time you have to respond to patient requests from 30 to 15 days and expand the definition of healthcare operations to include care coordination and create really a minimum necessary exception for case management. And so the estimated savings of $3.2 billion over 5 years. And so this originated under the Trump administration and aligns with current priorities, And so it is likely to move forward. All right, so we've really been kind of moving ahead. So we're going to have a decent amount of time for questions as I kind of get into this next section. Hopefully that doesn't mean I've been talking too quickly. But if so, then there'll just be some more questions. So we've covered each of the three frameworks individually. And let's kind of go into a bit why 2026 and 2027 is going to start to feel pretty overwhelming when it comes to all these data changes. So really, there's one foundation and three frameworks. So that's kind of the good idea, or sorry, the good thing here is there's been some foresight into making sure that all this stuff rests on the same foundation. And so really kind of like works together rather than necessarily opposed. And so a big part of that is FHIR being the technical standard. That's that common language that I mentioned earlier that systems use to exchange structured health data. And US CDI is the minimum data set. Again, this is kind of some technical language, but there's a lot of different specific data elements about patients that need to be exchanged, and those cover clinical data, social determinants, demographics, and insurance information. It's also a really flexible framework, FHIR is. And so it ends up that, you know, just because somebody's using FHIR doesn't mean it's exactly the same FHIR that the two are using, but it really is, it's a start. And so that's important. Then you have the TEFCA that we were talking about earlier that builds the pipes for the nationwide exchange. And so that links together these health exchange platforms that can be regional with kind of national ones, so you can get records from one place to another. And a provider doesn't really have to worry about what's happening in the back end. They can just kind of request that information. So the CMS rule opens data through payer APIs. And so again, that means things like getting access to whether a patient's been filling their medications, which is freaking huge, and things that have happened in prior insurance that they've had and records there, being able to access all that electronically. And then you have HIPAA setting the rules and securing the infrastructure and breaking down the remaining silos. And so because they all share that common FHIR foundation, one investment path serves multiple compliance requirements. If one builds a FHIR infrastructure for the CMS APIs, it's also building toward the TEFCA readiness because those same pipelines can just be kind of redirected. And if you implement security controls for the HIPAA overhaul, you're also securing your infrastructure for that TEFCA and CMS and that those rules and compliance depends on. So again, there's not necessarily any opposition between these. It's not three separate projects. It's one project that satisfies three different masters. But let's get into some of the overwhelming part. Look at the timeline and the dates here. In January 2026, that one's here. CMS phase one took effect. In theory, faster prior authorization decisions, specific denial codes, and public metrics reporting. The February 2026, again, already passed. The 42 CFR Part 2 alignment deadline. And so OCR enforcement active with penalties up to $1.54 million per year. Mid-2026 this year, the access model launches. And so this is value-based payment model requiring the FHIR APIs, HIE connectivity, and electronic care plan sharing. And so a lot of kind of the additional sharing things. And the HIPAA security rule may be finalized, though the timing is uncertain. And that's the one that ensures encryption, multi-factor authentication, and just tests to see if hackers can get into the system. So January 2027, all four FHIR APIs must be live under that CMS interoperability requirement. And so that's the one that patients can access their information, that providers can access it, that there's that prior authorization API. So that's really a big one that's going to open up a lot of data for you all, at least in theory and for patients. And later in 2027, the lead model launches. And so that requires population health analytics and some of these other kind of details that we didn't necessarily get into. But it's worth some scores there. At the end of 2027, Medicare telehealth flexibilities expires. And so without congressional action, that means that rural telehealth payment parity ends. And for a facility with one IT person or no IT person, this convergence really is impossible to manage without external support. So that's the honest truth. And so let's just talk for a second about what you all can do. All right. So what to do on Monday morning, next Monday. So three things are already enforceable. And so if you haven't really started on some of these, start now. So the first is 42 CFR Part 2 compliance. So again, the deadline has passed on this one. Enforcement is active. So update notice of privacy practices, consent forms, policies, and business association agreements. Those last ones are data sharing agreements. Train your staff on what SUD data sharing is now permitted under treatment, payment, and operations. And if you serve tribal communities, review your consent workflows against tribal governance requirements, not just the federal ones. Those are different. And that federal framework doesn't account for tribal data sovereignty. Second is multi-factor authentication and encryption. So whether or not the security rule gets finalized, there's near certainties in any version that comes out are going to require this sooner or later. So more importantly, 77 to 80% of large healthcare breaches are hacking and IT incidents. These are things that we read about all the time and, you know, new AI models that make it much easier to hack different systems just make this even more important. And in 2024, there were 725 large breaches affecting a lot of people. And so MFA encryption are directly designed to address these kind of threats. So I would say don't wait for the regulation to tell you what to do to protect your patients and your organization, just because the tools for doing this hacking are getting a lot easier. And these are the basic things to protect against that. And so third is the HIPAA risk analysis. And this is the most common enforcement finding. And so it shows up in virtually every settlement. Foundational for everything else. If you haven't documented a current thorough risk analysis, really that's kind of your first phone call Monday morning. And so some ones that are priority, they're not enforceable today, but they should be coming fast, 9 months to some of these deadlines. So a lot of these things rest on the EHR vendor. And so ask your EHR vendor about their TEFCA roadmap, things like USC DI support and their CMS interoperability timeline. And so if they can't give you a specific answer, that really tells you something important about that vendor. You depend entirely on their upgrade timeline for compliance. If they're not ready, you're not ready, and you can't really fix that on your own. Then connect with your regional HIE. Your regional HIE is increasingly the bridge between small facilities and the nationwide exchange. If your EHR vendor isn't going to become a TEFCA participant on its own, the HIE is going to be your on-ramp. And then also use the prior authorization transparency data. The first public reports from payers are in theory now available. So just look up the payer's approval and denial rates, compare them, and use that data in your conversations with them. And that's a lot of leverage that just really hasn't existed before. And then prepare for the CMS API, interoperability API consumption. And so by January 2027, payer data is really going to start flowing into your system through APIs. And so I would say work with your vendor now to figure out how you're going to incorporate claims histories, medication refills, prior authorization statuses into your clinical workflows without really drowning in information overload. It's a lot of really important, useful information, but it's a lot more information. And if you're in a value-based model, start thinking about the data infrastructure for population health analytics, the access and lead models tied to payment outcomes. And so you need data infrastructure to be able to measure those outcomes. Basically, a lot of this comes down to being prepared to access those data through working with external partners such as your EHR vendor and HIE, and then really getting ready to use those data in clinical practice and in your negotiations with payers. So, building for beyonds. These are long-term investments, but they're the ones that will determine just how much organizations thrive. And a lot of these are just kind of suggestions. So first is shared service models. And so just to kind of be direct, a lot of small rural facilities It's really hard to do cybersecurity, fire implementation, Tefka onboarding, and AI deployment all on their own. Those are pretty technical challenges. Rural facilities often don't have the staff, the budget, or the expertise. Shared service models, where multiple facilities pool resources for a shared cybersecurity operations center, pooled IT staff, and regional technical assistance, they're the most realistic path. So Texas is already using its rural health information platform program funding to deploy managed security solutions across rural providers, and other states are doing stuff that's similar. It's not theoretical, it's happening, and so really there's ways to pool resources to be able to make this happen together. Next is advocacy. So push for a regional extension center model for interoperability readiness. During the high-tech era, this was in the kind of early 2000s, the federal government funded 62 regional extension centers that provided hands-on, face-to-face technical assistance to small practices and rural hospitals for EHR adoption. And really it worked. So these are, you have 83% of federally qualified health centers and 78% of critical access hospitals participated in those programs. And likely that could help to implement a lot of these things for interoperability, and the rural health transformation program funding could also really support it if states prioritize it. Essentially, people on the ground that can help with these implementations, it's worked in the past, it can work again. And then think about really realistic AI entry points, and not necessarily the aspirational stuff that people love to talk about with, you know, omniscient AI that can replace all doctors and providers. What I'm talking about is administrative automation for PA submission and coding, some of the ambient documentation technologies for clinical notes, if you have broadband, and population health dashboards that can identify the care gaps from your existing data, and AI-powered cybersecurity monitoring. So these are tools that work, that really are getting proven out in the clinics, and can work at the rural scale as well, and kind of like using these things together to figure them out together. So where does the funding come from? That's always the key question with these, right? It's always fun to talk about cool technologies, but how do we pay for these? So there's really kind of two main sources. On the federal side, the Healthcare Cybersecurity and Resiliency Act, Senate Bill 3315, it's advancing through Congress right now. It's bipartisan, led by Senators Cassidy and Hassan, and it couples cybersecurity mandates with grants specifically for hospitals, rural health clinics, and IHS facilities. So it hasn't passed yet, and even when it does, the actual grant money depends on appropriations, but it's moving. And this is a way that really helps with complying with the authentication request, the encryption, all those details that are can be expensive to implement and maintain. And so the bigger near-term opportunity is the Rural Health Transformation Program. And so this is $50 billion over 5 years, which is $10 billion per year distributed to all 50 states. This is already flowing. First-year awards average about $200 million per state. And several states are specifically earmarking funds for EHR modernization, HIE integration, and cybersecurity. So, for example, Oklahoma is purchasing and deploying EHR hardware for rural providers. Indiana, Missouri, and New Mexico are funding HIE integration. Maine and Utah, where I'm from, are funding cybersecurity assessments and technical assistance. And so this money flows through your state and not directly to you. So the action item here is pretty specific. You're going to want to call your state office of rural health and really find out how your state is allocating its funds from this program and how you're able to access them. And so on the regional partner side, the Health Information Exchange, the HIE, is increasingly the bridge between your facility and that nationwide exchange that we've been talking about. They're becoming TEFCA participants, and you can connect them as a sub-participant. And so I'd recommend having those conversations to figure out, like, hey, how can this data flow? Because, again, it simplifies things for you. All right, so what gets better? Let's try to end it on something, you know, positive here. So prior authorization, this is really a big one, going from 70 times more expensive than it needs to be to what it should be the electronic default by 2027 through 2030. The infrastructure is being built. Your staff time on prior authorization should drop significantly as these come online. And ideally, this just leads to more approval for necessary care. I think there's a reason that a lot of people in the policy world and the provider world are excited about this. And even insurance companies are excited to not spend as much time on this process. And so behavioral health data also is flowing through standardized channels for the first time. And that's really big. That's important. And the part two alignment means integrated care for patients with co-occurring conditions. It becomes technically possible, not just aspirational. And so, yeah, the primary care physicians getting access to the data about their patients, that's important. Emergency medicine physicians getting access and providers and nurses to what's happening when that patient comes through the door and what their history is. That's really important. That's big and something to celebrate. And TEFCA has gone from concept to 500 million records exchanged across 70,000 sites in remarkably short time. The growth curve is steep and accelerating, and this is especially impressive as this one has no carrots and no sticks. There's no money incentivizing participation in TEFCA, and there's no penalties causing people to not participate. It's something that's kind of happening organically almost as they've organized this standard and way of doing things. People are jumping on, so I don't know. That's good. And then peer-to-peer exchange means that your patient histories will follow them throughout coverage transitions. And this is also big. So for populations with high Medicaid churn, that means seasonal workers, patients cycling through coverage changes, that kind of continuity is transformative for patient care. But there's still a lot of things that stay hard, especially on the technical side. And so that's that patient identifiability issue. So Samuel Smith, how do we pin all those down? The semantic gap, which is something that I do a lot of work on, both kind of in industry and in the lab. And that's once you have all these data that come through, how do you make sense of all that? If it's in, FHIR is pretty loosely formatted. How do you unify that with other types of billing data, et cetera? It's one thing to have a ton of data in hand. It's another thing to make it useful. And then the AI divide. So smaller, independent, and critical access hospitals, just really significantly less likely to deploy AI tools. And the barriers really are data infrastructure, technical expertise, broadband, and vendor dependency. And so the organizations in most need of efficiency gains from AI are often last in line to get them. And then tribal data sovereignty. And so TEFCA's common agreement doesn't account for tribal data governance. That needs a tribal data governance addendum, tribal-specific pilot programs, and meaningful consultation. OCR announced a tribal consultation in February 2026. That's a sign of progress, but really the gap persists. And then broadband's 22% of rural areas and 24% of tribal lands lack minimum broadband. And every piece of the infrastructure that I've described here, that's the FHIR APIs, cloud-based AI, telehealth, real-time data exchange, depends on this kind of infrastructure, this connection that too many communities still don't have. And no policy reform can really just fix that. It's just like physical infrastructure that needs to get built. So three takeaways. One, HIPAA does permit sharing. CMS mandates it, and TEFCA enables it, if you want to just kind of encapsulate it. Your job is to be right. The regulatory direction is clear, and it's not going to reverse. Data is going to flow more freely, more electronically, and more transparently. Position your organization to benefit rather than having to scramble to catch up. Two, one FHIR and U.S. CDI investment serves TEFCA, CMS rules, and HIPAA compliance simultaneously. You're not managing three separate compliance projects. You're building one piece of infrastructure that satisfies multiple requirements. That's the silver lining in the convergence. Three, start with what's enforceable right now. And so that means part two compliance for exchanging the substance use data. That means risk analysis and multi-factor authentication. And then really build from there. We can't do everything at once, and nobody really expects you to do everything at once. But those items that are on the do now list, are a lot of them are already past deadline, and enforcement in theory is active. So I would say get those done and move to the vendor conversations to make sure that the vendors themselves are well positioned. And if not, maybe get a new vendor. And so connected and comparable is the destination. We're part of the way there. So let's just keep moving. So thank you all for your time. Here's my email, which I'll kind of leave on the screen for a second or two. I lead the Medical Machine Intelligence Lab, and here are some of the members of the lab that do cool work in these different areas, and some of my collaborators in particular in computer science. So with that, we'll take some questions. Thanks.
Warren, thank you so much for that amazing presentation. I really think that you made a lot of really complex things coming down the pipeline very, very digestible. So we so appreciate your insights and efforts in this presentation. There's a lot of great questions in the chat. The first two are pretty closely related to a question that I actually had too, in regards to how can we find out if the facility that we work with or that we see our, doctors or, anything like that are involved with TEFCA. Specifically, the first two questions ask about the NextGen EHR and the Utah Community Health Information Exchange. And I know that you mentioned, community health exchanges in the presentation, but I mean, being that we're from Utah, you might have some insight on that. So,
yeah, I guess by we, do you mean as patients or as healthcare providers and
anyone who's on the presentation? I mean, how would any healthcare provider or I'm not certain about the patient side, but is there a way to find out if there's like a list of EHRs that participate? Facilities that maybe participate, how do we find that information?
Yeah, so a lot of that is going to be contacting, like within the health organization, the administrators or IT. And so there's a few levels to it in the sense that EHRs are kind of capable to participate, so they might have the functionality to do it. But even if they have the functionality, they might not necessarily be connected in, because the actual access to the data is controlled by the health organization, which is like also... so that means like Epic, has all these ways of connecting and sharing data. And in particular with the CARES Act, they're not allowed to put up blocks to that, but it's the hospital itself or the health system itself that controls access to that. And so that would mean if you're a provider, maybe contact the admin to figure it out. If you're in that administration and trying to understand, hey, what is the EHR vendor doing? Then contacting the EHR vendor and figuring out what their roadmap is. A lot of this stuff is changing so quickly that I don't know if there's a lot of reliable, up-to-date, hey, this is what it is. Also, a lot of the installations are pretty site-specific. And so there might be specific functionality that exists in Utah that doesn't exist in Montana, or something entirely different that exists in Colorado. And so one is you've got to contact people. And then the health information exchanges are also super useful just to understand what hospitals are on it as well. So that's kind of a way of almost circumventing to see, hey, what's already being shared is getting in touch with those health information exchanges. But a lot of it ends up with this IT stuff. You kind of got to go through the organizations to figure out what's where. And in theory, that's like the patient API stuff. Ideally is the way to make all this, not just the data more clear, but who has access to it. And so, down the line, patients will have a lot more access, and a lot of this will be more transparent.
Great, thank you. You had mentioned in the presentation about gaps in some of these initiatives, and one of them was patient identifiers. Someone in the chat asked, why can't a social security number be used as a universal patient identifier?
I think people are concerned of identity theft, probably.
Yeah.
So yeah, I could see that. I've never necessarily heard that raised in the conversations on it. I think, it's just confidential pieces of information.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, that would be easy for the patient to remember as well, yeah. Right? But again, like, there is that concern of identity theft. So that makes sense. But might be an interesting question to investigate later.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of ways to engage with these discussions as well. All these initiatives have public periods where people are allowed to submit comments and, There's a committee as an organization. So it's a pretty open process for those that want to engage with those ideas, because maybe that's a way to kind of move forward with it. But yeah.
The next question that I'm seeing is, how does this impact community behavioral health programs? I would imagine that a lot of those community behavioral health programs serve, you know, widely the Medicare, Medicaid populations. Is there any impact specifically to those types of organizations?
I mean, I think the 42 CFR Part 2 is probably the biggest one, and that's mandating the ability to share those data. And so a key thing is, there, it does require patients to specifically consent to kind of a broader sharing of the data. And so whether that means you have to go back and re-consent all the prior patients or not, those are the kind of legal questions that are still getting worked out. But I think that's going to be the big thing, is being able to get access to, in the same way you can get access to the electronic health record, getting access to prior treatment for SUD and some of the results there within the record without specific consents. I think that's going to be, I would think that is the biggest one.
And I think we probably have time for one more question before Arya has to kind of wrap up the presentation. So I'm just going to pull this one that was listed as the last one for a while, but it looks like we got a lot more questions. So we'll make sure that we take down those questions and then maybe send them to you later to be answered via email or another way. But this one says, there are hospital-based EHRs being offered to clinics for free or at a subsidized fee. They've seen clinics challenged with accessing their patient information through these partnerships, having to take legal action to define who is whose patient. Do you know if the Cures Act covers when an EHR host restricts information from a clinic like this?
I don't know that information. Okay. From what I'm familiar with the Cures Act, is it's primarily about the EHRs themselves. So it's been a big issue for a long time that certain EHR companies will not allow third parties to access their systems. And so the purpose of the CARES Act was primarily, there were a lot of purposes to it, but one of the key things, if a health system wants a third party to be able to access the health data so that the EHR can't block that, within a single EHR, kind of who owns the data, I'm not necessarily the expert to answer that. I think that's probably a legal question.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for at least trying. Yeah. So again,
it sounds really frustrating to whoever put that in there. I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's why I kind of wanted to ask it. Yeah. But yeah, again, thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. With all that being said, I want to also thank the audience for being here. We appreciate your participation and the wonderful questions that you submitted. Again, we'll try and get some of that information back over to the questions that went unanswered. But without further ado, I'm going to pass again to Arya to kind of close us out. Thank you.
Great. And I just put my email in the chat as well. So please send me those questions. I'll get back. And then if other people have other questions, feel free to reach out. So thank you.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you. Just a reminder that our next webinar will be held on Thursday, May 21st. That will be on Rural Health Transformation Fund, Workforce Trends and Implications for Rural Care. Registration information will be posted to the NCTRC events page soon. And lastly, we do ask that you take a few short minutes to complete the survey that will pop up at the conclusion of this webinar. Your feedback is very valuable to us. Thank you again to the Northwest Regional Telehealth Resource Center for hosting today's webinar. And thank you to Dr. Patin for his presentation today. Have a great day, everyone. Goodbye.